housing fiasco of a different sort, casualty loss issues. This is the Tax Update Podcast for February the 9th, 2009. Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research, confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely, so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document. Such prohibited use includes using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This week, we look at the case of a taxpayer who attempted to get a tax deduction for a number of issues arising from a botched attempt to build the taxpayer's dream home. In the cases of Grief v. Commissioner and Bui v. Commissioner, TC Summary Opinion 2009-18, the taxpayers had hired a contractor to build them a home in the state of Washington. But what happened was a Keystone cop set of miscues in building the property, building on the property, I should say, for which the taxpayers attempted to claim a casualty loss due to their costs incurred. Unfortunately, their choice of positions on the return turned out to be just about as faulty as the construction of their home, at least in the view of the IRS and eventually the tax court. The deduction of casualty losses in general is governed by Internal Revenue Code Section 163, which governs rights to claim deductions for losses in general. And it starts out in Section 163A that there shall be allowed as a deduction any loss sustained during the taxable year not compensated for by insurance or otherwise. And B tells us that for purposes of subsection A, the basis for determining the amount of the deduction for any loss shall be the adjusted basis provided in Section 1011 for determining the loss from the sale or other disposition of property. Section 163C, however, provides limitations on this deduction for individuals. And that provides, in the case of an individual, the deduction under subsection A of Section 163 shall be limited to losses incurred in a trade or business, losses incurred in any transaction entered into for profit, though not connected with a trade or business, and three, which is our key issue today, losses of property not connected with a trade or business or transaction entered into for profit if such losses arise from fire, storm, shipwreck, or other casualty or theft. Now, even if the deduction is allowed, Section 163H imposes other limitations and restrictions on the deduction. We're not going to deal with the floor issues and the 10% of AGI limitation today because those don't really become relevant for today's issue. Rather, our key question is that other casualties aspect of Section 163C3. What is an other casualty that would apply and give us the right to take a deduction for the loss? The key definition in terms of casualty is one that's not really defined in the code or regs. In fact, the tax court notes that in this case, it tells us, quote, that the term casualty is not clearly defined in the code or the regulations. Section 165C3 mentions losses arising from fire, storm, shipwreck, or other casualty. In defining the term other casualties, courts apply the rule of exuendum generis and look for characteristics similar to those of a fire, storm, or shipwreck. Courts have interpreted other casualty to require an undesigned, sudden, and unexpected event or a sudden cataclysmic and devastating loss. Our key issue is going to be those sudden losses that we're talking about in the end part of that discussion that the tax court gave us. The key issue here is looking to apply this treatment to the facts of the case we have before us for the construction of this home for the taxpayers. In this case, each of the taxpayers were claiming a loss of over $160,000 on their 2003 individual federal income tax returns related to the fiasco that involved the construction of a house on a piece of property they had purchased. The court begins by describing the history of this cursed piece of property and building and notes that the story begins in 1999 when it tells us that on May 4, 1999, petitioners purchased for $57,100 unimproved real property in Setac, Washington, with the intent of placing a personal residence on the property. The parcel was roughly square with boundaries from approximately 208 to 224 feet. The parcel had a relatively steep grade, dropping 60 feet from one side to the other. The improved real property had been appraised on April 13, 1999 at a projected value of $320,000 upon completion of the planned improvements. Their dream lot, as the court noted, had a steep grade that would turn out to present a challenge as we move the facts forward in this case. As well, there was no public sewer services available to that property at that time, and that also would turn out to be a significant issue in this case. The court goes on to describe the saga. The petitioner secured a $236,848 construction loan on or about May 28, 1999. They hired Gifford Olson as a general contractor to build the residence at that price. The construction began in June of 1999. Later that year, it was discovered that Mr. Olson had built the driveway on a portion of the area intended for the septic system drain field. Because this deviated from the plans approved by the city and violated the King County Health Department setback requirement, petitioners were denied an occupancy permit. Other problems included the removal of vegetation on the slopes of the property and the negligent construction of the road leading to the house. These errors created instability in the soil. Now, as you might suspect, having a house you can't occupy is a bit of a problem and creates some issues since you've now spent the money, built this property, and we discover we won't be able to live in it. But they did try to then correct the problem since it would be nice to be able to live in the property. But as it turned out, Mr. Olson wasn't quite up to getting this whole thing fixed. The court continues, the cost to correct the various problems mounted, and after drawing $182,500 from the $236,848 construction loan, Mr. Olson abandoned the project in June of 2000. At that point, the home building project was 70% complete. At the petitioner's request, the King County Board of Equalization reduced the assessed value of the improved real property to $23,000 on the basis that the parcel was considered unbuildable for lack of a sewer connection. As you might expect, at this point, the parties on each side of this transaction were not terribly happy, and their unhappiness spilled over into the Superior Court in Washington with a judge who decided there was plenty of blame to go around to everybody on this case. The tax court continues its summary. On September 29, 2000, Mr. Olson sued the petitioners alleging he was still owed $35,000 for materials and labor. Petitioners answered Mr. Olson's complaint, denying they owed any amount. Without setting forth a specific amount of relief, petitioners counterclaimed for breach of contract, negligence, and violation of the Washington State Consumer Protection Act. In addition to a few other complaints about Mr. Olson's performance, petitioners sought relief for the denial of the occupancy permit due to the misplacement of the road and the damage to the slope and the drain field. On March 13, 2002, Judge Michael J. Heavey, Superior Court for King County, State of Washington, issued a memorandum opinion in which he generally described the contractual dealings between Mr. Olson and petitioners as follows. The plaintiff, Olson in this case, and the defendant, which were the petitioners or the taxpayers from our perspective, were both greedy. The plaintiff saw an opportunity to break into full-scale home building, and the defendant saw an opportunity to get a custom home as opposed to a modular home. They ignored problems and cut corners. The contract and specifications they entered into were deficient. There was no survey of the lot corners. They both ignored that it was a difficult lot, with a challenging access, septic, and site location issues. No persons, contractor, owner, sanitarian, engineer, located the drain field and reserved drain field areas and flagged them off. They needed serious legal, engineering, architectural, and licensed sanitarian professional help. Their collective ignorance and greed blinded them to these realities. Both were reluctant to fully discuss and resolve overruns. They continually danced around these issues without fully addressing them. There was no schedule, no change order process, no definitions of allowance or default allowance, no clear statement of work, and no real specifications, i.e., a prescription for disaster. On the basis of these and other facts, Judge Heavey found that Mr. Olson did not commit a deceptive trade practice, but that he did default on the contract and negligently damaged the septic drain field. Petitioners, which is our taxpayers again, remember, were awarded costs of obtaining a new septic field design and approval and the cost of rockery or a retaining wall to preserve the drain field. Petitioners were also awarded a $38,150 judgment to supplement the $40,000 remaining in a construction loan in order to finish the home. So it seems a case where everyone, the judge, both parties, left the courtroom not terribly happy. The judge believed the parties deserved each other, apparently, and neither party ended up with a result that was anything like what they wanted at the end of the day. The taxpayers, however, kept trying and pushing their case to recover from the contractor, now looking to the contractor's insurance company. The tax court note that the taxpayers filed a claim with Mr. Olson's insurance carrier seeking to recoup $280,000 of alleged damage to petitioner's parcel by Mr. Olson. After discussions with the carrier, petitioner's attorneys advised them that Mr. Olson's policy did not cover the type of damage caused to petitioner's property. Petitioners during 2003 filed a claim under their own homeowner's policy but were denied on the basis it covered only damage to the improvements and not the realty. Petitioners, however, did not concede that the insurance companies were without liability. The saga, however, continued with the issue of converting the property into something that could be occupied, and there were developments on that front. But this time it was the taxpayers that appeared to drop the ball and caused issues to continue to drag out. The tax court noted that on March 9th of 2001, the King County Health Department granted Mr. Grief a waiver on the setback requirement. Petitioners were required only to submit the new plans for approval and to construct the septic system in order to obtain the occupancy permit. Neither was done, and later surface erosion invalidated the waiver. Petitioners' later requests for a new waiver were denied. But a bit more bad news was to come, this time from the steep incline in what had been done to the property. During April 2002, the city of Kent hired a geotechnical engineer to inspect petitioner's parcel of land. The engineer concluded there was instability in the slope and roadway alignment, which, if uncorrected, could result in a landslide and cause damage to the real property improvements. Petitioner subsequently hired a geotechnical engineering firm, Crazen & Associates, to examine the property. Crazen's reports made findings similar to the city engineer's. Petitioners contend that some earth movement occurred sometime between May 2002 and June 2003, resulting in the accumulation of soil along the eastern edge of the property and causing some damage to the vegetation and a gate. The taxpayers were back to the original issue of the judgment they weren't happy at, and they were trying to have the judge reconsider that as we continue our saga in another direction. But it turned out that Mr. Olson at this point apparently had some other financial issues going on and would eventually render the whole issue somewhat moot on collecting directly from him. On November 15, 2002, petitioners filed a motion for reconsideration and clarification of Judge Heavey's March 13, 2002 memorandum opinion. In their motion, petitioners pointed out there was evidence that it would cost $153,000 to correct the problems with the road that cut across the drain field. During a period of cross motions in the Superior Court proceedings, petitioner's motion for reconsideration and Mr. Olson's motion to dismiss, Mr. Olson voluntarily entered into a liquidating bankruptcy on May 1, 2003. In the bankruptcy proceeding, Mr. Grief filed a motion that was granted seeking to lift the stay as it related to his pursuit of Mr. Olson in the Superior Court proceeding. Petitioner also filed an adversary proceeding complaint objecting to the discharge of Mr. Olson's debt. Mr. Olson moved to dismiss petitioner's complaint, and on December 12, 2003, petitioner's response indicated they would not oppose the motion but would proceed with their action in Superior Court for King County. On January 8, 2004, the bankruptcy trustee filed a report of no distribution, and on May 11, 2004, Mr. Olson's claimed debt to petitioners was discharged. Eventually, in 2004, events finally occurred that allowed this couple, about 3 years after the date, to finally move into the residence. During 2004, development of the surrounding area made the municipal sewer system accessible to the petitioner's property. Petitioners were granted an occupancy permit, and they moved into the residence in the latter part of 2006 or early 2007. On January 25th of 2007, the petitioner's improved realty was assessed on the local tax rolls at $496,000, comprised of $69,000 for land and $427,000 for improvement. On October 26, 2006, petitioners stipulated to the Superior Court's dismissal of their suit against Mr. Olson. In 2007, petitioners accepted $7,500 from Mr. Olson's insurance carrier in settlement of their claim. And thus ended the long, arduous process of constructing their dream home. But they now ended up with the little tax problem issues that they had to battle due to the positions they'd taken on their tax returns. Key question, is there a casualty anywhere in all of this? Well, the taxpayers, figuring they'd been damaged here, reported, as noted by the tax court, the following items on their income tax return. Mr. Grief claimed casualty losses or theft losses with respect to the subject property on his 2001 and 2002 income tax returns of $23,000 and $48,000, respectively. Petitioners claimed a casualty loss for 2003 on the basis of their belief that Mr. Olson's bankruptcy rendered any relief in the Superior Court proceeding uncollectible, and also because of their inability to recover from the insurance companies. On their respective 2003 income tax returns, petitioners each claimed a $171,163 basis in the approved real property, no insurance recovery, and a fair market value of $250,000 before and $78,837 after the casualty. As all the facts in this case were stipulated by the IRS and the taxpayer before trial, the only question was how the law applied in this case. The tax court outlined the claimed losses for the taxpayers. They claimed two losses. First, they contend they were denied an occupancy permit because the damage to the septic system drain field made the septic area unusable and significantly decreased the value of the property. Secondly, they also contended that the land was rendered unstable when Mr. Olson removed that vegetation along the slopes of the property and cut the road too deep into the hillside. As we discussed initially, that loss that we're going to incur when we're going to get for a casualty loss needs to be a sudden, unexpected event. The taxpayers argued it was. They argued that the damage to the drain field and slope was sudden because it was not caused by gradual deterioration, and it happened over a fairly short period. The court goes on to note that they argued that the damage was unexpected because such damage does not usually occur during construction of homes on similarly situated properties. The court notes that they correctly observed that negligence itself is an automatic bar to a casualty loss deduction. As well, the foreseeability of an event or the presence of negligence does not preclude the finding that the event was a casualty. The court clarifies that both are merely factors in making such a determination. Generally, I would tell you not positive factors, but factors. The court noted, however, that faulty construction itself isn't sufficient to get a casualty loss, to clarify this point. Rather, it needed to eventually lead to a casualty. The court clarifies that casualty losses have been allowed in faulty construction cases typically where there has been a subsequent, unexpected event apart from the contractor's negligence. They look at the case of Marks versus Commissioner, where a subsequent leak in a taxpayer's roof arising from his negligence repair were casualty loss, but the original leak from the faulty construction was not. Or the case of Hyten versus Commissioner, where flood damage proximately caused by faulty construction of a taxpayer's home, but by a plumber stepping on an unprotected pipe. So again, in both cases, it was not the faulty construction itself per se that was the casualty. Rather, it was an event that took place afterward that may have taken advantage of the faulty construction. The court found that their particular fact pattern was not going to qualify. It notes, and we quote, "Nevertheless, we hold the petitioner's losses were not casualty because neither was a result of sudden or unexpected events. Damage caused by faulty construction methods has long been held not to constitute a casualty loss. In their litigation against Mr. Olson, the court found that Mr. Olson mistakenly encroached onto the area of the septic system drain field while excavating for the driveway. The petitioners contend that the damage to the drain field site occurred when a subcontractor negligently drove a bulldozer over the area. Regardless of how the drain field was damaged, the end result was the placement of the driveway over a portion of the intended drain field site. When this occurred, the location of the driveway no longer conformed to the approved plans and violated the setback requirement. For that reason, petitioners were denied an occupancy permit and the property lost most of its value. Whether the encroachment onto the drain field was a result of negligent excavation or a bulldozer running over the area is irrelevant. Denial of the occupancy permit was based on the driveway being too close to the drain field. The improper placement of the driveway is simply a matter of faulty construction. Once the driveway had been constructed, there was no later event that caused further harm to the property. But there was that issue of the landslide, you may remember, or the risk of a landslide. And the taxpayer argued that, at the very least, this gave him a casualty loss. The petitioners cite the Hine case, the court noted, as an example of the allowance of a casualty loss based on a contractor's negligence. In Hine versus Commissioner, the contractor unilaterally deviated from the described excavation method and was warned of the likelihood of a landslide occurring. Nevertheless, the court allowed a casualty loss because the physical characteristics of the landslide were those normally associated with the casualty, and the landslide involved a sudden and violent movement of a large mass of earth that was cataclysmic in character. However, in this case, the problem we're going to run into is the court doesn't agree that any such landslide took place, or at least took place in the issue between May 2002 and June 2003. The court continues to note, we have held that the magnitude of the taxpayer's loss is another factor considered in the casualty loss analysis. See White versus Commissioner. It was the physical characteristics and magnitude of the taxpayer's loss which the court in Hine found akin to the sudden and devastating loss during a fire, storm, or shipwreck. Petitioners contend the soil instability culminated in a landslide sometime between May 2002 and June 2003. However, the record does not adequately support this contention. The geotechnical engineer's report from Crazen merely notes instability created by the removal of vegetation from the slopes and the steep angle of the driveway. The report stated that if those conditions were not mitigated, there would be an adverse effect on the property, but it made no mention of a landslide. Similarly, a letter from the Department of the Army notes the city engineering's manager made the same observation about the instability on the property. The letter is dated June 11, 2003, after the purported landslide, and also fails to mention that such an event occurred. In the absence of such an event, petitioners have experienced only instability in the slopes of their property. This is not the type of loss that can be considered sudden, cataclysmic, and devastating, or the result of an undesigned, sudden, or unexpected event. The court also noted that the taxpayer's own negligence had caused them to lose the ability to obtain the occupancy permit earlier and mitigate their damages. The court noted that, furthermore, a taxpayer may not knowingly allow his property to be damaged or willfully damage the property himself. Petitioners were granted a waiver on the setback requirement and could have thus obtained the occupancy permit, thereby mitigating the loss they suffered. By failing to pursue the variance, petitioners knowingly perpetrated the impediment to completion of the real property improvement. In the end, the court found that the petitioner's loss was a product of Mr. Olson's negligent construction and not some unexpected event. There was no devastating or cataclysmic damage to the property, such as a landslide. Petitioners could have remedied the occupancy permit problem, but they neglected to take the necessary steps to do so. We accordingly hold that petitioner's loss was not a casualty. Okay, maybe there's another problem. Well, if we look at it this way, now the court goes on after having killed it once, they go on to kill it again because they note there are other issues that would cause the loss of this deduction, showing what the loss is. In a footnote, the court justifies continuing the analysis because noting, we consider whether petitioners have established the amount of a loss because the petitioners have made generalized alternative contention that their loss was a theft loss. The court would conclude they hadn't shown how much they had lost, therefore whether it was a theft or not would become irrelevant. The court noted the deduction is limited as follows. The amount of a particular casualty loss deduction is limited to the lesser of the difference between the fair value market value of the property before and after the loss, or two, the adjusted basis provided in Section 1011 for determining the loss from the sale or other disposition of the property. The first problem the taxpayers have is establishing what was the difference between the fair value before and after the loss, and the court found their evidence here to be lacking. The court notes the petitioners have not met their burden of establishing the amount of their loss. They have not demonstrated the value of the property before their loss. They purchased the property on May 4, 1999 for $57,100. No appraisal was made at that time. They did submit an appraisal performed before the purchase, April 13, 1999, as proof the property was valued at $320,000. However, the report was marked subject to completion per plans and specifications. Construction of the home began in June. The encroachment of the driveway into the septic system was discovered later that year, and construction had not yet been completed at that time. Therefore, the property could not have been worth as much as the full estimated value in the appraisal report. The next valuation of the property was not made until after the petitioner's loss, when it was assessed at $23,000 for the 2000 tax year. As noted, the problem here was there was no evidence of what the fair value was at the time the casualty took place or the theft took place. The court also noted that the proof of basis in this case was lacking. Noted that they didn't deal with the timing of when basis was created versus when the loss took place. And we should also note they had some rather inconsistent numbers over time. The court goes on to note the petitioners have also failed to establish their adjusted basis in the property at the time of the loss. They now contend that each had an adjusted basis of $119,725. They arrived at that number by adding the $57,100 purchase price of the parcel to the $182,500 already paid to Mr. Olson at the time he stopped work on the home in June 2002. These calculations are imprecise, and the measure of their loss has more to do with construction of the driveway over the drain field site. They have not documented how much of the $182,500 paid to Mr. Olson was for work done afterwards. Such amounts are not probably included in petitioner's adjusted basis at the time of the loss. Based on that, since they had shown neither of the above, the taxpayers had a little problem. You should also note that the basis they claimed to have by the time we got done with this, each having adjusted basis of 120, ended up being substantially less than their claimed losses on the property. That also would turn out to be a problem down the line when we get to penalties. Finally, just in case the deduction wasn't dead enough yet, the court goes one step further. It had another theory as to why they were deficient. They had not established the lack of prospect for recovery when they claimed the loss. The taxpayers claimed they had no reasonable prospect of recovery once the insurance company denied the claim. They contend the denial of coverage by Mr. Olson's insurance carriers proved they had no reasonable prospect of recovery. They note their attorney advised them on January 21, 2007 that Mr. Olson's insurance property did not in fact cover their claim. However, the court found the taxpayer's own actions were inconsistent with that position. The petitioners litigated the denial of coverage, and we accordingly hold they have not met their burden of proving a reasonable prospect of recovery did not exist at the end of 2003. In Mr. Olson's 2003 bankruptcy proceeding, petitioners stated Mr. Olson's insurance carrier was liable for many of Mr. Grease's claims against him. Petitioners requested that the stay be lifted so they could proceed against the insurance carrier. As of December 12, 2003, petitioners indicated their intent to continue with litigation against Mr. Olson. While petitioners' decision to litigate does not decide the issue, it does demonstrate that they had not abandoned their claim for reimbursement. With the ongoing litigation, it could not be ascertained with reasonable certainty that the petitioners would not prevail in their suit against Mr. Olson and recover the judgment from his insurance carrier. The continuation of this litigation in 2006 and the fact a settlement was reached in 2007 suggest a reasonable prospect of recovery did exist. The fact that the petitioners maintained their claim for insurance reimbursement and had a reasonable prospect of recovery at the end of 2003 also mitigates against them allowing them a casualty loss deduction. The problem here was they claimed the loss, but they continued to litigate. Presumably, if there was no reasonable prospect of recovery, you would have stopped the litigation at that point. They did not. And in kind of a backdoor, not so wonderful side event, shall we say, looking at this down the line, they ended up winning in the case to the extent of getting a reimbursement of $7,500 eventually. And the mere fact that they kept going to 2007 and there was finally a claim paid, admittedly not a very big one, but a claim paid, worked against them in demonstrating that back in 2003 that the loss had existed because there was no reasonable expectation of being repaid. Finally, to add insult to injury, the tax court decided that the negligence penalty should apply. It notes that their underpayments are also attributable to negligence. They claimed a total adjusted basis of $342,326 on their 2003 returns, but they provided no documentation as to how they arrived at this figure. And I would note in passing, that's a very precise number to suddenly have no idea how you came up with it. Petitioners have since claimed the adjusted basis was $239,450 without explaining this discrepancy. Both petitioners claimed casualty loss deductions of $171,163. The deductions far exceeded the $239,450 the petitioners now claim to be the property's total adjusted basis. Even if we assume the $239,450 figure is correct and ignore the property's pre-loss values, petitioners claimed casualty losses plainly exceeded the adjusted basis limitation on their casualty loss deductions. So in the end, the taxpayers lose, don't get their casualty loss, have to pay the tax, have to pay the interest, and get stuck with the penalty. Looking back at this case, I think it's a useful one, largely because it walks you through virtually all the issues you may have to walk through in a casualty loss deduction case. It also walks us through some of the issues that we have to worry about when documenting or proving certain items, including things like prospects for recovery, and tying down little things like bases in property when we go to do calculations that impact bases in the property. many cases, we run into fact patterns that look like this, where nobody's really kept track of things very well. In fact, as the judge in Washington noted in this case, these guys were trying to kind of cut corners and, you know, do things quickly and easily without actually paying for everything. It's kind of a giant do-it-yourself project to some extent. Created its own sets of problems that we have to unravel. But note the importance of making sure that you unravel these property, as well as making sure the mere fact that the taxpayers weren't damaged, and there seems to be little question that the taxpayers suffered economic harm during all of this, does not by itself automatically give rise to a deduction. Taxpayers have to meet the requirements of Section 163 to get relief. This has been the tax update. Now, what I'm doing now, I'm starting to actually post some things on, if you haven't ever used the Twitter service, www.twitter.com. I've actually started doing some posts there when I do things, or when I post podcasts, do other issues, or do anything else that comes to mind, or any issue that comes up. So I post updates there. You can follow me. I'm Ed Zollars, just E-D-Z-O-L-L-A-R-S, on Twitter. You may want to take a look there. There are other services. Some of the state societies of CPAs are actually posting things to Twitter right now with updates. We see quite regular posts from the Ohio Society online, if you take a look and follow them on Twitter. Twitter's tougher to explain, easier to just do, and finally figure out how it works. You can take a look at that and make use of your various Twitter clients that are out there. This has been the Tax Update for February 9th. Tax Update, as always, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Be sure to go there and consider subscribing to their email newsletters. This has been the Tax Update.